Mr. Domingo carefully considered implementing the plan, specifically saying he wanted to sleep on it for a few days. He then gave the final go-ahead last Thursday, and the dummy bombs were delivered Friday evening during a final meeting with the two undercover operatives. Mr. Domingo received instructions on how to detonate the devices he believed to be bombs, and then he drove with the two purported Confederates to Long Beach, where they walked around the area of the planned rally to find places to plant the bombs where crowds would likely gather in order to inflict the maximum number of deaths. He was arrested shortly thereafter.
Federal officials detailing how they foiled a Reseda man's alleged plot to detonate a bomb in Long Beach over the weekend. We'll talk about how the FBI snares terror suspects later in the show. First, though, let's turn to Venezuela, where there are violent clashes today between anti-government protesters and military forces. It appears to be an attempted coup. There are videos of tanks mowing over people in the streets and of soldiers throwing tear gas to break up crowds. These clashes came hours after opposition leader Juan Guaido called on civilians to oust the president, Nicolas Maduro, and for the military to defect to support him. Guaido called it the final phase of Operation Liberty. Here to talk about what's happening in Venezuela is Philip Reeves, international correspondent for NPR covering South America. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. All right. Is this actually a coup? Is everyone calling it that?
Well, actually, no, they're not. The U.S. government is saying it's not a coup. This is Juan Guaido asserting his legal right to take over the presidency, form a transitional government, and hold fresh elections, a position the U.S. and more than 50 other countries have held for some months now. And the Maduro government is saying this is not a military coup. It is a coup, but it's a coup that is being orchestrated by the U.S. And involves Guaido, and that the army remains loyal. So it's viewed rather differently by both sides in this dispute.
Well, there is some dispute about where the army is. So Guaido saying that he has support now of the military. Maduro saying, no, the military is staying with him. What's happening with that?
Well, there isn't any concrete evidence that a significant element of the high command of the Venezuelan military has abandoned Maduro and moved on to Guaido's side of the equation. That evidence isn't there yet, although this particular drama is in quite an early stage. But there are some significant symptoms of something going on, and one of them was the fact that Juan Guaido appeared in a video alongside some soldiers with armored vehicles at an air base in Caracas today, and with him was Leopoldo López, who is this very influential, prominent opposition leader who's been under house arrest, and before that in prison, who had somehow managed to secure his release. If it was the military or the intelligence services that allowed that to happen, then the suggestion is that they have abandoned Maduro and joined Guaido. Pictures unclear, no sign yet of a major defection from the high command to Guaido, but certainly something going on.
So Guaido basically declared himself president in January. So why is this erupting now, four and some months later?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was Guaido asserted what he said was his constitutional right to become president because Maduro's election last year for a second term was a fraud. It was illegal. Guaido quickly won recognition from the U.S., which is playing a very prominent role in all of this, and then more than 50 other nations joined him in supporting him and recognizing him as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. And since then, there has been a series of efforts to push Maduro out, including some very important and punishing U.S. sanctions, which prevented Venezuela from selling its crude oil to the United States, which therefore deprived Venezuela's government under Nicolas Maduro of a very important chunk of its hard currency income, and put an even greater squeeze on an economy that was already collapsing. There have been other things, I mean, demonstrations held by Guaido quite regularly, some of them very large, and a repeated call for the military to come to his side in exchange for amnesty. So this is a progressive, this is a progress that they have been working on for a long time. It's going step by step, and we're seeing another step now.
Okay, so you mentioned these sanctions having a very punishing effect on the economy. Can you just describe what that looks like? How are Venezuelans coping, just ordinary Venezuelans, on a daily basis?
It's very tough for the majority of Venezuelans, and it's getting tougher, not least because, as well as the loss of the collapse of the economy, which has been going on now not just for months but for years, hyperinflation, which runs into seven figures, difficulty acquiring food, and in particular, and this is very important, medicine. But in addition to all of that, they've had a wave of recent power outages, some of them very large and prolonged and nationwide, and that has meant shortages of water, difficulty keeping what food they have, breakdowns in communication and transport. So life is very tough, and people are concentrating on just trying to get by. And in addition to all of that, 3 million Venezuelans have left the country to find work and try to survive elsewhere, mostly in the immediate neighborhood in South America. And that makes it very tough for the people who stayed too, because they have lost family members and don't know where they are and find it difficult to contact them and so on and so forth. It's very tough for Venezuelans right now. And the evidence is that in the short term, at least, it's going to carry on being very tough for them.
And how does that exodus of 3 million people leaving and going to neighboring countries, how is that affecting the region, the larger region? And today, Colombia's president came out in support of Guaido, Bolivia's in support of Maduro. What's going to happen in the larger region, do you think?
Yeah, most of the big players in the larger region are in support of Guaido and against Maduro. Notably, Colombia, which has taken the brunt of this wave of migrants, and it's been under tremendous pressure because of that. Also, Brazil, now under the recently elected far-right government of Jair Bolsonaro, and most of the others too. And indeed, they are meeting to discuss their next move today, I believe, in the light of the latest developments in Venezuela. Colombia in particular is having a really tough time because of this. One of the ironies, though, of the migration is that people who've left Venezuela then repatriate whatever income they can somehow manage to acquire outside of the country, send it back in to support their struggling relatives at home, which means that in a roundabout way, that kind of helps prop up the Maduro regime, because people are able to get an income source from there, helps them get by. So it's a complicated situation and quite a tragic one.
Yeah. All right, we'll keep an eye on it as it unfolds. Philip Reeves, international correspondent covering South America for NPR. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we are just taking a few seconds in between stories to ask you to go online at kcrw.com/join and support us in our UnDrive Fund Drive. This is how we stay on the air, is you. So we get donations from you, our listeners, renewals, new subscriptions, whatever it takes to keep the lights on, to keep reports like that, all that great information about what's happening in Venezuela. You're going to hear a lot more on the show today and throughout the day on KCRW, news that you don't get anywhere else and culture you don't get anywhere else. This is something to support, and you know it. This is the UnDrive, which means we are not interrupting programming. We are just talking to you for a little bit, a few seconds in between our shows and in between our stories to get you to support this station. So if you like this, the non-haranguing approach, the non-interrupting programming approach, please support it. We really do count on you. And this is an experiment, so we're relying on you. Come on, do it. KCRW.com/join. All right, coming up on the program, how the FBI foiled an alleged terrorist plot here in Los Angeles. They used an informant, but would the suspect have carried out his plot without the encouragement of that informant? We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are new details about how the FBI caught an Army veteran who was allegedly planning to bomb a right-wing rally in Long Beach. Prosecutors say 26-year-old Mark Domingo had also considered targeting police and setting off a bomb at the Santa Monica Pier. He could face up to 15 years in prison. Domingo was arrested after chatting online with an FBI informant for weeks and taking what he thought was a bomb from an undercover investigator. But how do we know if Domingo would have carried out this plot if he had not been encouraged by the informant? Joining me to talk about the foiled plot is James Quealy, who covers crime and policing for the LA Times. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
Good to have you. Okay, give us a quick rundown on the suspect. Who is he and what do we know about him?
Sure. So Mr. Domingo is an Army veteran. He served in Afghanistan for about 4 months from late 2012 to early 2013, left the military shortly thereafter, according to the FBI. No one has officially explained his discharge status. We did hear from a source it was a non-honorable discharge. He then pops up, he lives in the area. He lives in the Reseda area, pops up on the FBI's radar in early March of this year. He had started really in earnest putting up posts about wanting to commit violent acts, kind of as revenge for crimes committed against Muslims across the globe, specifically the mass shooting in Christchurch, New Zealand on March 15th. Mm-hmm. So that is when the FBI first makes contact with him, because he makes reference to possibly killing Jewish people, killing Christians in an online post. At that point, a confidential human source for the FBI starts talking to him, and they start discussing the possibility of carrying out an act in real life. That's when these discussions about possible shootings begin, and he kind of starts expressing, myriad targets he might want to attack. Like you mentioned in the intro, he references shooting at an LAPD cruiser at one point. He references attacking a military installation. There's one point where they drive past the port of Long Beach. It seemed to be very sporadic, almost whatever he saw was the target, and then he does settle in to aim at this rally that was scheduled for Bluff Park in Long Beach this Sunday. But as you said, the FBI, through their use of the informant and through this undercover officer, gave him an inert device that he believed could be a pressure cooker shrapnel bomb, kind of akin to what was used in Boston in 2013. Mm-hmm. They gave him a fake version of that, and upon him taking possession of it, they arrested him on Friday without incident.
So did he have weapons or any other was his plot advanced in any way before he met the informant?
So he did have possession of three rifles in his name, two of them semi-automatic, one bolt action. And if you look through the court documents, there are multiple occasions where he references possibly using the guns to just attack anyone. There's a specific reference to pulling up alongside a Los Angeles police cruiser and just shooting at the officers inside. There's at least one meeting before they have a concrete plan between him and the informant where he shows up, at least according to the federal prosecutors in this affidavit, he shows up in camouflage carrying one of the semi-automatic weapons. So there has been criticism of the FBI in the past, the suggestion that when they do these online stings and they bring this material support for terrorist charge, there is criticism that they almost advance the plot, right? They hop onto or glom onto a mentally ill person who is exhibiting violent tendencies and possibly through their actions maybe move the target closer to actually committing an act than they might have been on their own. I don't know if that's really the case here. There's a couple of different occasions where the informant almost seems to try to be talking down Domingo. There's one point where he makes reference to the fact that Domingo had only recently converted to Islam. We don't exactly know when, but it was sometime in the past few months. And I believe the informant says to him, the exact quote is, you don't have to do this. You know that. You're pure. So in this case, the informant almost seems to be urging the defendant to back off, which is not the case in most of the situations that people are critical of the FBI.
Hmm. But he did suggest the IED, right? The informant did?
Yes. Yeah, the informant introduces the concept of the IED after the like I said, after Domingo had repeatedly brought up the concepts of just sporadically using the firearms. Like I said, again, there was one point where he seemed to just be on a whim mentioning the idea of possibly shooting at Los Angeles police officers.
Okay, so has he, Mark Domingo, has he in any way explained himself or entered a plea or anything like that yet?
He made his first appearance in court yesterday, did not enter a plea. He's going to be detained through a May 31st hearing. I believe he's being represented by a federal public defender, and as I'm sure you know, they don't normally talk about their clients. So we have not heard much from him or his attorney. His family did release a brief statement effectively saying that, you know, this is not who he was. He was not, in their eyes, they'd never seen him violent or express outrage, but we haven't really heard much more about him personally beyond what's in the court documents.
All right. James Quealy, covering crime and policing for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Trevor Aronson for more on how the FBI uses informants. He's the executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so how often does this happen, this kind of scenario where the informants are used to flesh out someone who might be considering mounting a terrorist attack?
So since 9/11, there have been more than 300 defendants like Domingo who have been caught in these either informant or undercover agent-led stings where there's an allegation that they were, you know, furthering the interests of a terrorist group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So it's actually become quite common, and, you know, the FBI's tactics have become quite aggressive in ferreting these people out.
Right. And so what do you make of what James was talking about here, about how the FBI does receive a fair amount of criticism for perhaps moving a plot along that may not have gone further along unaided? But in this case, it seems like he had some serious plans and had the weapons already, or some of the weapons.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's a bit exceptional about this case is compared to other terrorism stings, is it's more common for the defendant to be someone who has absolutely no capacity, you know, no money, no weapons, you know, no capacity to get weapons on their own. And then the FBI provides everything they need, provides the, you know, the bomb, the transportation, whatever it is they need to further the plot. In this particular case, it's a little gray in that Domingo had rifles, as the LA Times reporter noted, and, you know, had talked about harming people, and also given his military background would have had some training. So there is a capacity question. There is perhaps an argument that he had greater capacity than, you know, the average person caught up in these kind of sting operations, which in the past target people who, you know, are mentally ill or sometimes have behaviors that suggest they are mentally ill. I would say that in this case, I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, his interest in violence seems less ideologically motivated than, you know, some sort of weird bloodthirst that he had. I mean, his targets, you know, varied by the day, according to the affidavit. I mean, he talked at one point about even harming his neighbor. And so I think there is a real question of, like, would this person have done anything were it not for the FBI? Would he have gotten involved in some sort of, you know, ideologically motivated attack, or would he have harmed just someone randomly? I think that's really hard to say. You know, and the other thing worth noting is, you know, as was noted earlier, the FBI informant did provide an opportunity to back out and say, you know, you really don't need to do this. And I think the FBI, in facing criticism that this case might not have been, you know, someone who would have moved forward in a terror plot, will point to that. And they point to that in a lot of these cases. And so the FBI makes a point of trying to say, like, look, we offered them an opportunity to back out, and they chose not to. And that's true. But that often happens very late in the process when the person is largely kind of mentally and emotionally committed to whatever violent act they're talking about. And I also think it's important to point out as well that, you know, in the affidavit, Domingo clearly states that he has no ability to make a bomb, and yet it is the FBI that provides that weapon here. And so I think, you know, in looking at this case, I mean, I think this strikes me as one that, yes, this is a questionable terrorism case. I also think it's a kind of question about veterans and mental health. I mean, this mm-hmm. is clearly someone who was troubled, had served in the military, was talking about harming people. And, you know, instead of perhaps getting help, he's set up in this terrorism sting that makes him look like he's a supporter of ISIS, when in fact there's no evidence to suggest he was ever in contact with ISIS. And, you know, so I think that's, you know, in many ways kind of the troubling aspect of a case like this, yeah. Which is that, you know, we can't say for sure that he wouldn't have done anything, but the plot that he's ultimately charged with and the connections to ISIS were all kind of largely manufactured by the government in the sting operation.
Right. But I guess in this situation, the FBI doesn't want to take any chances. And maybe this sting operation is the best way to get him, you know, off the streets, if you will, and away from his guns, because you can't arrest someone just for having guns and voicing some, you know, some opinion online, right? They have to have engaged right. in some material aspect of a support for a terrorist plot.
You know, when I've challenged FBI agents on this and pointed out, like, look, some of the guys that you're catching in these sting operations are clearly troubled, have mental illness. You know, a common response that I get from them is to say, look, we're the FBI. We're not a social services organization. That's not our job. And I think it's also important to point out that, you know, there should be some empathy for this difficult position that the FBI is in. When they catch someone like this before they strike, they have people like me and others say, like, well, maybe they pushed him along. And then when they miss an attack where someone attacks and the FBI wasn't aware of it, the criticism they get is to say, like, well, how come you didn't know? How come you didn't stop it before this happened? And so FBI agents are in this very difficult position of not wanting to be the person who says, like, hey, look, this guy is just mentally ill. Let's just let him go. And then they drop the investigation and find out a month later that he shoots up people in a shopping mall. I mean, that's an FBI agent's worst nightmare. And so that's important context in understanding why the FBI does what it does. At the same time, though, it's worth pointing out that there has never been a real case where someone who didn't have the capacity to acquire a bomb, you know, meets an ISIS or Al-Qaeda operative and that person gives them the bomb. You know, it's only been the FBI in cases like this where you have people, you know, involved in bomb plots that, you know, they are not capable of committing on their own. And it's the FBI that provides the weapon. And so I think, you know, yes, this guy seems like a very dangerous guy, and he's probably better that he's not on the streets right now. At the same time, is he, you know, someone that we should consider an ISIS terrorist and kind of in line with some of the ISIS attacks we've seen? And I think that's a highly questionable thing.
All right. We'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Trevor Aronson, Executive Director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and author of the book, The Terror Factory: Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. All right, I'm taking a quick break right now to get you to go online at kcrw.com/join on day two of our UnDrive to either renew your membership, add a couple bucks onto an existing membership, or become a brand new member. This is our spring fundraiser. We only do two a year, and we're really taking a risk with this one. We're saying, hey, we're not going to interrupt the programming in exchange for you guys doing the right thing and supporting it during our brief pitch breaks. Very brief, few seconds. So 800-600-5279, 800-600-KCRW, or kcrw.com/join. You'll be automatically entered to win the Austin City Limits Music Festival sweepstakes. So that's exciting too. Lots of information about that online. So you can check it out at kcrw.com/join. $20 a month. How about it? All right. Coming up on the program, how to speak to your kids about TV shows which have explicit sex talk in them.
Just to say, I noticed you're watching this show. I was really curious. I watched a couple of episodes. I'd love to know what you think about X, Y, and Z, or could you believe it when this went down? What'd you think about that?
I'll talk with a sex educator about three new popular shows that deal with teen sexuality next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for our TV segment we call TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh, my God! They've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yoke, sell.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, today we're talking about shows that deal explicitly with teen sexuality. And because of the subject matter, parents, this discussion might not be appropriate for everyone, so be warned. To start off, here's a clip from the Netflix show Sex Education.
Looks fun.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it feels like?
What, rimming?
No, sex.
I don't know. I think it'll be nice. It feels good to wank, so it must be like that, but better. And doing it with someone who likes you must be awesome because they really get you. Maybe the two of you become one, like the Spice Girls said.
Okay, so that's Sex Education. It's made in Britain, obviously. There's also Hulu's Pen 15 and the animated Netflix show Big Mouth. So do these shows actually provide valuable sex ed for teens? And should parents be involved in some way if their kid wants to watch them? We're joined now by Shafia Zaloom. She teaches sex ed at the Urban School in San Francisco. She also consults on Big Mouth. Hi.
Hi.
Well, let's begin with Big Mouth from Netflix.
How come in all these videos, puberty for boys is like a miracle of ejaculation, and for girls, we're just a yarn ball of aching tubes?
Ew, that's gross.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we need equal pay.
My dad says when you take into account maternity leave, you do get equal pay.
Okay, so it seems like there are a lot of themes there to pull apart. What is Big Mouth about?
Big Mouth is about puberty. It's about middle school and the ways in which, you know, the human experience of wrestling through that time in our lives that can be super challenging and incredibly joyful, that is sort of fraught with all kinds of new and interesting ways by which our bodies are changing, how we see the world is changing, how we interact with others is changing. So it really highlights all those different aspects of puberty.
And what do you do on the show? How do you consult for it?
Oh, it's been pretty limited, although I've spoken with the writers. You know, they're in the room and we Skype a couple times. And they're genuinely interested in what's going on with kids. You know, the sweet spot of my teaching and consulting is middle and high school. So they want to know, you know, what are kids dealing with? What are some of the issues that will resonate with them? How can we be responsible in how we roll these out? And then I've also had some of my students talk with them. You know, the Big Mouth writers are interested in, well, what issues do you want to see dealt with? What could happen next? What do you think would be interesting? What's real and relevant for you all as you are, you know, walking this path and journeying through this time, going through puberty, the throes of puberty?
And what are the main issues these days? Are they any different from the issues we've all dealt with?
I mean, I think that there are some that have transcended time, certainly. And then there are others that are completely new and different, depending on how old you are. But I think social media in particular is a huge one. Also, too, our cultures, our greater cultures, sort of glorification of impersonal sex and ideas about sex that may not be the most productive for young people as they, you know, consume popular culture.
Right, because a lot of kids see porn online,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So how do these shows handle that?
Well, there was one in particular called The Pornscape that Big Mouth did in their first season that really showed, I thought, the pieces that were really interesting and highlight what's real for kids is that, you know, one kid became compulsive in his watching and the other didn't.
Andrew, this isn't who you are. You're not a sex freak. You're a sweet guy. You don't like all of this. You like Missy.
No, it hurts too much out there. Nobody can hurt me in here.
But this isn't real.
It is to me, Nick.
So, you know, it brings that up. It highlights, okay, so this is real for a lot of kids. How as parents can we then have a conversation about pleasure, masturbation, what's healthy, what isn't? Porn is a very limited representation of sexuality and not representative of most people's sort of healthy, you know, relationships and sexual practices that have to do with safe sexual interaction.
Okay, well, speaking of that, let's move on to the Hulu show Pen 15.
I'm like Sam, only I'm grosser because I'm a girl and I'm a pervert and I really shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I've been putting my hands down my pants on my area. Feel good.
Okay, so these characters are supposed to be 13-year-olds, but they're actually played by 30-year-olds. So
yes.
Maybe is this show maybe more for adults?
I think it would appeal more to adults or for adults because that's one of the sort of premises of the show itself, that the actresses are actually playing their middle school selves, although they're surrounded by actual middle school kids in the show. And what I love about this show, the clip you played in particular, is that it's normalizing female pleasure. And I think that's super, super important, especially these days. You know, there's a lot of double standards when it comes to who can indulge in their pleasure, in their sexual pleasure, and who can't. And by that, I don't mean being, you know, sexually active prematurely or anything like that. I mean, just discovering and exploring what sexuality is for someone as an individual. And in all these shows, there are episodes in which they focus on this. So in Big Mouth, it's called Girls Get Horny Too. And she actually, Jessie talks to her vulva. I love that scene. I think it's great. I have a vulva puppet that I teach from, and I always imagine that would be the voice of the puppet.
Wait, who plays the voice of the puppet?
I think it's Kristen Wiig. And I just, I love it. It's perfect. It's the best. I use it in my class all the time. So I think it's great that we're having these conversations. I think that despite it being for a more adult audience, that that clip you just played from Pen 15, there are young people who are watching it. Absolutely. You know, parents should be aware of what their kids are watching and watch it themselves so they can have conversation.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about that. The parents, you think, should know, but often kids are in there rooms or on their devices apart from their parents, just downloading these shows, watching them, and maybe they don't want to tell their parents they're watching them. So how would parents actually know their kids are watching these shows, and what should they do when they find out? How should they talk to their kids about it?
Well, to have an account, it's a parent who has to set it up and pay for it. So I think that it's important that we pay attention to those different you know, what's being watched on those accounts. Like, I'll pull up the account and I'll see, based on, you know, who it's shared with and who's watching, because you can create a profile with the shows that you like, sort of look at the history in terms of what's being viewed. And I think you use language like, I noticed, you know, kids experience why, like, why are you watching this? Or what are you up to? You know, we want to actually approach the conversation from a place of curiosity. We want to lead with empathy. We want to engage in an exploration and conversation that leads to discovery, not one that leads to guilt and shame. So for kids to talk with open honesty, it's really important that we create a context that's free of ultimatums and judgment, guilt and shame. And just to say, I noticed you're watching this show. I was really curious. I watched a couple of episodes. I'd love to know what you think about X, Y, and Z, or could you believe it when this went down? What'd you think about that? Or what's your favorite parts? What are the parts? Are there any parts that confuse you? And then also be able to point them in the direction of medically accurate resources that can help them understand sort of what's been piqued in terms of their curiosity. If they don't necessarily feel comfortable asking all their questions of their parent.
Like, what's a medically appropriate resource?
Well, I think that, you know, medically accurate resources would be Planned Parenthood. There's online resources, Sex 101, also Scarlatine. There's actually quite a few out there.
Okay. Well, that's good. That is sex education you just gave us. So thank you for that. Okay, finally, speaking of, let's talk about the British Netflix show. We heard the clip in the intro. This is a British show about a teenager whose mom is a sex therapist and an author. And then he's a virgin, and he begins his own sex consultancy business at his high school. What do you think of that show?
It's so funny because being a sex educator, so many of my students, I became aware of it because so many of my students came up to me and said, Shafia, and my children who are teenagers go to the high school where I teach, and they all,
that's awkward.
Yes. And they're saying, Shafia, you have to watch this. Have you watched it? Oh my gosh, we want to talk about it. Please watch it. You know, so I started watching it, and I watched, I think, all of the episodes in two sittings. And I enjoy it. There are parts of it that I think are brilliant. There are parts of it that sort of pique my awareness around, you know, concerns having to do with normalizing certain aspects of sex culture that I don't think are necessarily healthy for young people.
Like what?
Or Well, so a lot of the sex is very explicit. It's pretty sexually sophisticated. It's very edgy, and it's pornified to a certain extent. So it's a very narrow representation of sexual exploration.
Well, I guess I'm wondering what you mean by pornified.
There isn't a lot of exploration and sensuality that's explored in certain ways. There's a couple scenes where, pleasure and fantasy is explored as you get deeper into the episodes, which I think, is much better. But in the beginning, the opening scene of the first episode is not about true connection, not about knowing each other really well. The girl is faking her pleasure and her orgasm, and the guy is really disconnected, and it's very explicit. It's not very intimate. There isn't this physical closeness or emotional connection that's being expressed between them. The intercourse itself is intercourse you would see in typical sort of high-speed internet porn.
As I hear you speak, I think this is educational, not just for kids.
Absolutely. I mean, part of it is, when it comes to sex education, we've been really inconsistent in terms of who gets it and who doesn't. We live in a pretty sex negative culture, and by that I mean there's a lot of sex stigmatization, a lot of objectification, body shaming that's still a part of our culture, and it's organized by gender in a lot of ways as well. I think it's important that, we use these shows to pique our own curiosity and to do our own research and to educate ourselves too.
Shafia Zaloom, health educator at the Urban School in San Francisco and author of the forthcoming book, Sex, Teens, and Everything in Between. All right, Shafia, that was fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
Great.
Was that okay for you? We get to everything.
Well, funny you should say it that way. Okay. Okay. Hello there.
Why do I get to follow that piece?
I know. There's not a lot more you can say after that. Okay, Steve Chiotakis is here. He's got
Great.
A brand new show coming up after this show called Greater LA. What's on your show today?
We're talking about vaccination. That's the controversy, right? The anti-vaxxers are out there saying that there could be a link to autism. I don't want to vaccinate my children because I don't want to, I'm worried about the risk.
Right.
But doctors and public health officials are like, you have to have your children vaccinated because of the 90-95% rule to eradicate these diseases.
And measles is making a huge comeback.
Big comeback. We've quarantined schools now, UCLA, Cal State LA. So it's a big thing. KCRW Saul Gonzalez went and talked to some anti-vaxxers who were protesting Adam Schiff at one of his rallies a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to hear more about that coming up.
Okay, fantastic. Tune in. Steve Chiotakis, Greater LA, Day 2.
Day 2.
All right, don't miss it. And coming up on this program, how to make a croissant. It's really hard. No, it's not. It's pretty easy. Baking tips from Ray Publique's award-winning pastry chef next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Chocolate-filled eclairs, flaky buttery croissants, mushroom and leek brioche tarts, raspberry pistachio Queen Amans. These are just some of the pastries on display every morning at LA's République. The restaurant on La Brea usually has a line out the door by 8 a.m. The woman behind that overflowing pastry case is République's pastry chef Margarita Mansky. And if you have been dying to learn how she gets her croissants so flaky, well, you can learn. She has a new cookbook out. It's called Baking at République, Masterful Techniques and Recipes. And she joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
Great to
so
see
happy
you
to be here.
Outside of the kitchen.
I know. I'm dressed even different, which is weird.
So this idea of an overflowing pastry case, you write about it in the book. It's important to you. Why is it so important to you to have that?
I think I'd love a full anything when I offer to guests. And I think it's maybe part of the Filipino culture where when you invite somebody to your home, you just overfeed them no matter what. Even if they're like saying, no, I don't want any more, you're like, have some more. And
so it's a sign of hospitality.
I think so, yeah, for sure. And another thing is right when you enter the door of the restaurant, that's the first thing you see. And I think seeing that full case it's just a great impression. You automatically have a smile on your face and you're just excited. So
yeah,
I think that's one
and
of the
And you're thinking
reasons.
Of dessert before you're thinking of the main meal.
For sure. <laughs> You're just... <laughs>
So you did not train as a pastry chef formally.
Formally, I mean, I went to a little bit of pastry school, but not formally. Yeah.
You trained on the savory side.
Trained on mostly on the savory side, yeah. And I had like short stints, you know, with pastry chefs, but definitely maybe 95% of the time was on the line.
So when did you make the switch and why?
I think my husband and I moved to Carmel to open this little restaurant, 50-seat restaurant.
In Northern California?
In Northern California. And there was only four of us in the kitchen. You know, can't afford to hire a pastry chef at a 50-seat restaurant. And I think I had the most experience as far as pastry. And they're all like, we don't want that. So it fell on me, you know, to tackle that station.
Was it hard at first?
It was challenging for sure. I think because of my training in the kitchen and the savory side, I like the spontaneity of like, okay, let's do this, let's do that. You can kind of like switch around things, but in the pastry, there's a little bit more planning.
You grew up in the Philippines.
Yes.
And you grew up in a cooking household.
Yes, family, I would say, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so when did you first start cooking in restaurants?
Oh my gosh. My mom owned a small I wouldn't even say restaurant, maybe a cafeteria in front of a college before. And it was my sister and I would like be behind the counter serving them food.
And how
I think
old
I
were
was
you?
7 years
seven.
Old. Yes.
Did you reach the counter?
I think people were probably thinking, what is this little girl doing? Are you serious? But yeah, that was one of the first experiences. And of course, my parents owned a restaurant as well. And every summer I would just be in the kitchen with them.
So basically, you grew up making food, being in restaurants. So it was natural for you to open restaurants here.
I think so, yeah, for sure. I mean, there was nothing else that I thought I would rather do, you know, that from 5 years old, baking in the kitchen, being my mother's restaurant. My grandma owned a restaurant. My aunt owned a catering business. And I loved it, you know. I loved being in the kitchen. I loved helping them do stuff. I loved, you know, everything that was around me during that time.
And so why did you decide to open a restaurant in Los Angeles rather than the Philippines? And also this restaurant on La Brea, it's just a famed site, right?
I mean, for sure.
Campanile, it's a famous restaurant. I mean, so it has a storied history, this location.
For sure. Well, I met my husband, so we just decided that, you know, it was time for us to open up our own restaurant, execute, you know, what we wanted to do, our vision and what we were passionate about. And yeah, Los Angeles is where we landed. And this building is, I mean, we can't even believe it until now that we were able to, you know, open a restaurant in that building. Because like you said, it's historical, and it being Campanile before and La Brea Bakery, mm-hmm. You know, at first we were nervous, like, what if we can't live up to that? Or people know it so much and love it so much. It's so beloved, you know, Nancy Silverton and Mark Peel. But I think things worked out, I guess.
Yeah, it's hugely popular.
It's
so your husband does the savory side and you do the pastry side.
Yes. Yes.
And that works out, that separation of
labor? That works
labor?
Out very well.
How often do you talk to each other?
I mean, every day. I mean, it's great to work side by side. And also it's great to, you know, have that, you know, you're doing this and I'm doing that.
Do you ever try to tell each other, well, maybe you should try this, or maybe you should do this?
Every day. I mean, every day. And that's what's great about working side by side, because he looks at things at a different perspective. And we don't agree all the time. But I think him telling me his perspective and me telling him, then we get, at first, sometimes I don't agree with him and I'm like, no, you're crazy. But after thinking about it, I'm just, yeah, you're right. You know, that might be a great idea. And then we come up with something really good.
And you're talking about collaborating on recipes?
On recipes, yeah.
Can you give me an example?
Oh, gosh. There's so many. Actually, a great example is the halo halo.
And what is halo halo?
It's the quintessential Filipino dessert. And it's got all kinds of stuff. Beans, name it, fruit, just weird stuff.
And it's kind of ice creamy?
Yeah, and it's topped with crushed ice, ice cream, evaporated milk, ube is there. Mm. And I wanted to serve, okay, let's serve the traditional halo halo. That's what I grew up with, so that's what we're doing. But then he was like, well, how can you do that? We don't have all the ingredients, and it's better to serve what we have here, you know? It's better to serve fresh fruit. It's better to serve this, that, that. So at first we were like kind of arguing and I was like, no. And he's like, well, that's what I would do. But then we ended up doing a twist on it where we serve what we have here, which, I mean, we have a great farmer's market. So we get all the fruit from the farmer's market. And we ended up doing, instead of just plain crushed ice, it's like a flavored ice that's seasonal. So if watermelons are in season, we make a watermelon ice to go on top of it, which I thought turned out really good. And so that's one of the examples, yeah.
It's a recipe in here, too.
That's in the book.
So you can actually make it at home? I mean, it seems so complicated. It's a little intimidating.
I mean, the great thing about the dessert is you can put whatever you want in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's halo halo. Halo halo in the direct translation is mix. So it's literally mixing whatever you feel like in a glass, topping it with ice. If you want flavored ice, watermelon, mango.
But it's like shaved ice.
Yeah, shaved ice. Yeah. Yeah. Like a granite.
Yeah. So that's funny because that's kind of goes to the savory side of your cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just can improvise rather than
sure.
the strict.
Gotta
follow the order. Let's talk about that side of it, and let's talk about your croissant dough recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I think most home cooks are a little intimidated by the idea of making their own croissants.
Mm-hmm.
So can you break it down for us? How do you make it so
flaky
and delicious?
The book is, yes, it's got recipes, it's got measurements, it's got, okay, do this, do that. But I think you should always look at the book as a guide. And that's what I do at work all the time. You know, I take something and I improvise. And it's not, there's no rules, really. I mean, and I think that's what you have to think about when you're making something. And sometimes, a mistake even leads to a great discovery. So with the croissant, I mean, don't be afraid. Just go for it. You might, I mean, the first try might not be the best, but, you know, practice makes perfect.
And does it take a long time to make croissants?
It takes quite a bit of time, but even if it's not a perfect croissant, it's going to taste good because how can you go wrong with a lot of butter?
Exactly.
Flour.
Exactly. Butter solves all problems. How long did it take you to perfect your croissant recipe?
Well, we've been open for 5 years, so I think through the years we've definitely tweaked here and tweaked there and just improved it. You know, we were using a different kind of butter in the beginning, and you know, we just tried different kinds of butter.
Does it matter what butter you use?
For sure.
What do you use?
Well, we use a French butter, laminating butter, which is not, I don't think you can't find it in any grocery store, but that doesn't matter. You know what I mean?
Well, what should we use?
I mean, just use a good quality 82% butterfat butter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you do a Kerrygold?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, butter tastes good. So it's just personal preference as well.
That pastry case that's full at 8 a.m., when is it not full? When is it emptied out? At what time? And you don't replenish it, right?
We don't replenish it. It's usually gone by sometimes 1 o'clock 2 o'clock. Yeah.
And that's it.
And that's it.
And yeah. Then you're making stuff for the evening, like cakes and pies and things like that.
Yeah. Well, we have dinner service, completely different menu from the daytime. So then we prepare desserts for that. Yeah.
So you have a long day.
I have a long day. And also, aside from that, we're just continuously prepping for what we need the next day as well for the case. So it doesn't stop.
Wow.
Yeah.
What time do you start?
On the weekend, we start at 3 a.m. And then on the weekdays, 4 in the morning. Yeah.
You get to sleep in?
It's great. Yeah, a little bit.
Hour.
A little bit.
And then you're there until the evening?
The day is usually a 12-hour day, you know. But coming in the morning, people say, "What? You're crazy." But it's so nice to come in the morning at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. The restaurant is completely quiet, empty, very clean. You know, you're just doing your thing, working, you know what I mean? And you can definitely focus more because there's less distraction around you.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today. And it's like the middle of your day or the end of your day, actually.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Margarita Mansky, pastry chef at République. Her new book of recipes is out now. It's called Baking at République, Masterful Techniques and Recipes. Okay, that is it for Press Play. Well, it actually is not it, because I have about a minute and a half to get you to go to kcrw.com/join or go on the phone, the telephone at 800-600-5279 and get you to renew your membership or become a new member or just add a little bit extra on to your existing membership, because this is our spring fundraiser. It is our UnDrive, and this is the second time we're trying it. It is really an experiment, so fingers crossed that this is going to work. We are not interrupting any programming for this fundraiser. This is really revolutionary in public radio, as you know, because usually it's a lot of talking and I'm interrupting programming and it gets to be a drag. So we heard from you. You said, we don't like this very much. And really, honestly, who does? So this is what we're doing. We do need your support. So we don't really know any other way to get it but to ask you. And so your part right now is to say, yeah, I kind of like this UnDrive idea. So I'll kick in a few bucks and do my part to support public radio, because as they say, radio is public because you are the public and you support it. So kcrw.com/join. It is so exciting because there's a whole bunch of great swag online you can check out. We always have a new design for our hoodies and for our t-shirts. So check that out at kcrw.com/join. $20 a month. That seems pretty reasonable for most of you. So consider that. All right. And also, when you donate, you will be automatically entered to win the Austin City Limits Music Festival sweepstakes. Tons of reasons for you to go online right now and join. And thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.